Queen Carvania stood haloed by the morning sun. An army hung on her every word.
My champions, I have sold my chariot on Carvana. 'Twas a lovely SUV, an inexplicably queenly offer. They're even coming to the castle to collect it. Tonight, we feast!
An offer you can feast on. Sell your car today on Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
Beneath the headlines, behind the timelines, there is a story no one wants you to find. Welcome to Some Unapproved Thinking, where forgotten truths, buried patterns, and invisible systems rise to the surface. You weren't crazy. You were just early. Let's begin.
You know, it's funny how we often take certain narratives for granted. Like the story of pandas being these cute, cuddly creatures we just want to save. You know, the typical Save the Pandas campaign that we always hear about. But like most things that seem straightforward, there's often more to the story. Today, we're diving deep into what I like to call the panda disinformation campaign. You were taught that pandas are cute, endangered, naturally occurring creatures that accidentally became icons. That's the story they wanted you to believe. But the real history of the panda, the deliberate construction of panda diplomacy as a geopolitical weapon, has been buried so deep that even most conspiracy researchers don't know where to look. And once you see what actually happened, you'll understand why governments still control the panda narrative today. This is Some Unapproved Thinking.
Thank you to our sponsor, the Dark Horse Entrepreneur Podcast. Unlock your potential with the Dark Horse Entrepreneur AI Escape Plan, the podcast empowering hardworking parents to break free from the 9-to-5 grind through AI-powered side hustles. Check them out at darkhorseentrepreneur.com. Now back to the show.
In 1961, the World Wildlife Fund needed a logo, a symbol of global unity. Something that would transcend politics. They chose the giant panda. Specifically, they based the logo on Chi-Chi, a panda living at London Zoo that year. But here's what they didn't tell you. That choice wasn't random. It was calculated. It was orchestrated. The panda wasn't selected because of its endangered status or its biological significance. It was selected because of where pandas lived and who controlled that territory. The bamboo forests of Sichuan, Shaanxi, and Gansu provinces in mainland China. The panda became the perfect cover story for something far larger. China in the 1950s and 60s was isolated, economically fragile, diplomatically radioactive after the Korean War. The West had no direct access to Chinese markets, no foothold, no leverage, but they needed one. They were losing the Cold War in the East. The Soviets were gaining influence. And then someone, and we may never know exactly who, in the State Department or the intelligence community first proposed this, realized something crucial. If you could make the world fall in love with something that only exists in China, you could make the world negotiate with China. You could make governments care about China's relationship with the West. You could, in essence, manufacture consent for diplomatic engagement without it looking like capitulation. That's when the panda narrative began. The World Wildlife Fund was founded in 1961, and immediately, and I mean immediately, they made the giant panda their symbol. Not the African elephant, not the Bengal tiger, not even the Arabian oryx. Nope, they chose the animal that lived in the one place the West was trying to penetrate, mainland China. The timing is not coincidence. This is coordination. The panda became the Trojan horse of soft diplomacy. Every conservation effort, every breeding program, every celebrity sighting, it all functioned as a mechanism to normalize relations with a country the American government had been trying to destabilize for a decade. The panda was the face of that reversal. The panda made it acceptable. But there's a deeper layer, and this is where most people stop thinking because it seems too absurd. The panda itself may not be what we think it is. Western scientists didn't have sustained access to living pandas until the 1960s. Before that, all accounts came from Chinese sources, from scattered reports by explorers, from colonial-era anecdotes. No Western naturalist had conducted a comprehensive biological study of the panda in its native habitat. No one had verified its breeding patterns, its actual population numbers, its genetic markers. It simply existed in Western consciousness as a rumor, a legend. A creature from the Chinese interior that was so rare, so elusive, that hardly anyone had ever seen one. And then, suddenly, as soon as the geopolitical incentive aligned, pandas became available for study, for export, for display in Western zoos. For the whole world to fall in love with. Coincidence? Consider what happened next. China begins gifting pandas to select Western nations as diplomatic gestures. By the 1970s, following the famous ping-pong diplomacy that cracked open U.S.-China relations, the panda gifts shifted decisively toward Western allies. Premier Zhou Enlai presented Ling Ling and Xing Xing to the United States after Nixon's 1972 visit. Japan, America's ally, received pandas. Nations in China's diplomatic favor received pandas. This is not conservation. This is currency. The panda becomes a token of favor, a symbol that you have a special relationship with China. Every zoo that housed a panda, places like the Smithsonian National Zoo in Washington, was essentially flying a flag that said, "We have access. We have favor. We matter to Beijing." And every government that received a panda and every citizen who visited that zoo became psychologically invested in protecting China's image, because you protect what you love. And the panda was designed to be loved. But here's the mechanism most people miss. The panda is presented to you as naturally endangered, struggling to survive in the wild, threatened by habitat loss and human expansion. And here's a detail that tells you everything. In 2016, the IUCN, the International Union for Conservation of Nature, the official body that sets these designations, quietly downgraded the giant panda from endangered to merely vulnerable. The crisis narrative softened exactly when it needed to, but by then, the infrastructure of emotional investment was already built. This narrative is not false, exactly, but it's weaponized. Because if the panda is endangered, then conservation efforts become morally necessary. And conservation efforts require cooperation with China. And cooperation with China requires maintaining stable relations with China. And maintaining stable relations with China means your government cannot criticize China's human rights record, cannot restrict trade, cannot apply pressure on geopolitical issues. The panda becomes a moral shield. China gets to do what it wants, and Western governments get to tell their citizens they're saving the pandas. Everyone feels good. Everyone complies. The money proves it too. Modern panda loan agreements, because China never gives pandas away anymore, they loan them, these loan agreements cost roughly $1 million per panda per year paid directly to Chinese government-affiliated conservation bodies. $1 million per panda. Per year. The Chengdu research base of giant panda breeding, the facility that manages most of these international placements, operates under direct state oversight. Follow the money, and the conservation narrative leads straight back to Beijing's treasury. The breeding numbers prove this further. From 1961 to today, China has maintained such tight control over panda breeding data that independent verification is nearly impossible. You're told there are roughly 1,800 pandas in the wild. But where did that number come from? Well, from Chinese government surveys, of course. How were they conducted? Unclear. When was the last Western independent census? Never. The world accepts China's word on panda populations because rejecting that data would require rejecting the entire conservation narrative. And rejecting the conservation narrative would require admitting you were manipulated. Most people cannot do that. So the numbers stand unquestioned. And then notice what happens when you do question the narrative. You're not labeled a skeptic. Nope. You're labeled cruel. You're told you don't care about endangered species. You're made to feel morally wrong. This is the trap. The panda narrative weaponizes compassion against critical thinking. It makes you feel guilty for asking questions, because in asking, how do we know these numbers are real, you're implicitly asking, do I care more about pandas or about geopolitical manipulation? And because the panda is so cute, because you've been trained since childhood to love the panda, you, of course, choose the panda. You choose to believe. The doubt dissolves. And once again, the system persists. But wait, we are not done yet. It gets darker. Because the panda's role in geopolitics didn't end with initial rapprochement. No, no. It evolved. As China's economic power grew, and as projects like the Belt and Road Initiative extended Beijing's reach across dozens of nations, the panda narrative shifted with it. It stopped being about opening dialogue and started being about maintenance. About control. Every time a Western nation criticized China on labor practices, on Tibet, on intellectual property theft, China reminded the world that they controlled the pandas, that the pandas lived in China, that pandas could be removed, breeding programs could be shut down, and access could be revoked. You see this played out in the trade agreements, the sudden availability of pandas to favorable nations, the sudden unavailability to critical ones. The panda is a carrot and a stick all wrapped up in black and white fur and conveniently cites the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species requires all panda transfers to go through Chinese government approval. The regulatory framework itself became part of the control structure. The deepest irony is this. The panda is not even uniquely endangered. The giant panda is not more threatened than hundreds of other species. The Bengal tiger, the Javan rhino, the Arabian oryx. Many of these face far greater extinction risk, but they don't have the geopolitical utility of the panda. They don't live in a nation the West needed to negotiate with. So they don't receive the funding. They don't receive the media coverage. They don't receive the breeding programs and the international cooperation. The panda gets all of those things, not because it's the most endangered, but because it's the most useful. Its rarity is its power. Its adorability is its camouflage. And you are supposed to never notice the difference. What's particularly genius about this disinformation campaign is that it's self-perpetuating. Even now, even with this knowledge, even knowing that the panda narrative serves geopolitical interests, you still love pandas. You still want them to survive. And that's the trap closing right before your eyes. Because your desire to save the panda makes you complicit in everything the panda represents. You become invested in maintaining good relations with China so that panda programs continue. Your compassion has been weaponized. Your morality has been colonized. And the system grows stronger because you care. So now, the question you have to sit with, and there is no comfortable answer, is this. If you learn tomorrow that pandas were not actually endangered, that populations were stable, that the whole crisis narrative was fabricated to serve diplomatic objectives, would you feel relieved or devastated? Because your honest answer to that question reveals how completely the manipulation has worked. If you feel devastated, if the idea of a stable panda population would somehow feel like a betrayal, then you've been perfectly programmed. The system has won. Your emotional investment has become indistinguishable from the truth. This is the underhanded mechanism of modern disinformation. It doesn't spread through lies alone. It spreads through beautiful lies, through narratives that make you feel good about believing them, that make you feel moral, that make you feel like you're part of something larger than yourself. The panda narrative does all three. It tells you that you care, that you're helping, that your love for a creature translates into meaningful action. And maybe it does. Maybe pandas do benefit, but you'll never know for certain because you've been trained to never ask the question. The final trap is the one you're in right now. Having listened to this, you now have three options. You can dismiss it entirely and return to loving pandas without doubt. You can accept it fully and become paralyzed by the knowledge that your compassion has been manipulated. Or you can live in the middle, knowing the truth, still caring about pandas, but never quite certain which part of your caring is genuine and which part is programmed. Most people choose the third option. Most people choose to live with the uncertainty because certainty is too painful. And that uncertainty, that cognitive dissonance, that's the actual victory. Not the panda, not the diplomacy, but your permanent doubt. But hey, the panda is still adorably cute. So at least that part was never a lie, right? This has been Some Unapproved Thinking. Tracy, out.
If this story didn't sit right with you, good. You're not here to be comforted. You're here to see what others overlook. Thanks for exploring Some Unapproved Thinking. Learn more at someunapprovedthinking.com. New episodes drop weekly. Subscribe, share, and keep questioning, because the pattern's still playing out, and next time, we're going deeper.